Welcome to the seventh and final season of Inspiring West Virginians. I'm Jean Snediger. In the next hour, you'll hear the story of a world-renowned emissions engineer, Dan Carter.
From the beginning, the thing that struck me most about Dan, he was competent and confident, but very humble.
Of a young NASA scientist, Justin Ellis, who works in the hot new field of gravitational wave astronomy.
What I think is remarkable about Justin is that he's brilliant, but he's also a true scientist in the sense that he's modest and he'll keep trying to find the truth.
And a businessman and entrepreneur from Summers County, Ken Allman.
Ken Allman is a very interesting individual in that he has more ideas in 5 minutes than I'll have in 5 years, and did everything that he could within his power to benefit the folks in his hometown of Hinton, West Virginia.
All of them are outstanding leaders in science, engineering, and business. We like to call them inspiring West Virginians. First, the story of a country boy from Wood County who's become one of the world's great emissions engineers.
This is actually a small engine we're using to do particulate filter development work, used for transportable refrigeration units. We'll probably be running for about 5 hours.
I'm Dan Carter. I'm a mechanical engineer. I grew up in Wood County, in a small town called Mineral Wells, actually Grassy Run Road, and came to West Virginia University. I'm now the director for CAFE, the Center for Alternative Fuels, Engines, and Emissions here at West Virginia University. We are a research enterprise within the Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering Department. Our center has been around for 25 years. We've done about $100 million worth of research, and I've been involved in the center from its inception.
46-year-old Dan Carter leads a team of faculty members, staff engineers, technicians, and more than 30 master's and PhD students. They carry out pioneering emissions research and testing, from mining equipment to refrigeration units to heavy-duty trucks to passenger vehicles, using all kinds of fuels, gasoline, diesel, biodiesel, hybrid, and electric systems. They're trying to find that perfect balance among competing needs of power, fuel economy, fuel efficiency, and low emissions. First, I'm getting a tour of their research building. Upstairs are giant exhaust systems which simulate what happens in a car or big truck, so that researchers can test whether or not a vehicle meets federal regulations.
These are referred to as dilution tunnels. Basically, this is a large filtration unit here, HEPA filters. Conditioned air is brought in, so we control for temperature and humidity. We then mix that air with exhaust inside this tube. That simulates kind of what happens at the tailpipe of the engine. And at the end of this tube, you'll see there's a number of probes and sampling tubes. And that's how we extract off small portions to actually look at the exhaust.
They then test the exhaust for particulate matter, gases, and other chemicals. Although this is a world-class facility, a lot of the testing equipment isn't commercially available.
A lot of this welding I did myself when myself and another technician were working on, a couple engineers, working on building this. Most of the systems we have here, we design in-house. Even the large physical systems like this, the fabrication and welding is all done in-house by, you know, many of the researchers or our engineering and technical staff. Students get involved as well.
And they are pioneers in the way they test engines. In the late 1990s, there was very little data about how engines behaved in the real world. Everything was tested inside in a lab, either on a machine called an engine dynamometer, or dyno, or a giant vehicle treadmill called a chassis dynamometer. Then, Dan and his team at CAFE built the first mobile emissions testing unit. It's attached to the back of a vehicle to test engine emissions on the road. In 1998, using this method, the CAFE team discovered that some heavy-duty diesel engines that would not have passed U.S. emission standards out on the road were using cheat devices that allowed the engines to pass U.S. emission standards in a lab. Despite this pioneering work, CAFE's accomplishments went mostly unsung outside the industry. But then, everything changed. Friday, September 18th, 2015.
I was actually in the emissions test cell at our research lab. My cell phone had been ringing, but I'd had it on a windowsill ledge kind of charging. I think I walked over to the phone and you know, noticed there had been a number of missed calls and numbers I didn't recognize. Turned around to go back to what we were doing, and the phone rang again. So then it was kind of out of frustration, I think. I picked the phone up, and I probably wasn't very cordial when I answered. The lady on the other line said, I'm so-and-so from, and I believe it was NBC News. I wanted to have a couple words with you. Do you have a moment? And I said, I probably answered something like, sure. And she said, you have no idea why I'm calling you. And I said, no, absolutely not. And she said, well, I'm going to give you a few moments to go check the news and collect your thoughts, and I'll call you back in about 5 minutes.
Dan checked the internet and learned that one small project that he and a team of five at CAFE carried out in 2013 and 2014 showed that the world's largest automaker at the time, Volkswagen, was using a clever scam to beat emissions tests. It programmed the car's onboard computer with what is known as a defeat device to make it seem that their diesel cars were burning cleaner than they actually were. When the team from WVU took the cars out on the road for testing, two Volkswagen models registered anywhere from 10 to 35 times the government emissions guidelines. At the time, the CAFE team thought perhaps this was just some problem that Volkswagen could easily fix. But the EPA then did their own testing, which confirmed CAFE's findings, and they announced it publicly in September 2015.
I knew at the instant, you know, the reports were already, you know, this is going to be a billions of dollar settlement. So I called the dean of College of Engineering, and he said I should contact Dr. Fred King, who's the VP of research here at WVU.
It was interesting because Dan was his usual kind of low-key self. And then he starts to sort of unfold what this is about. And I'm thinking, wow, this is a pretty amazing story.
I said that it's going to be a $20 billion fine. And he said, wow, $20 million is a lot of money. And I said, yeah, Fred, $20 million is, but $20 billion is even more. And he said, oh, you said B as in billion. And I said, yes. He said, oh, my goodness, you need to call legal. So
the announcement unleashed a firestorm of media coverage of what Volkswagen had done and the little team at West Virginia University who had discovered their deception. 4 days later, Volkswagen said that 11 million of their diesel vehicles worldwide had been fitted with the cheating device. The next day, Martin Winterkorn, the top CEO at Volkswagen, resigned. Dan Carter and his colleagues at CAFE were shocked by the whole scandal. They really like diesel technology, and they want it to succeed.
From an engineering standpoint, the diesel engine has inherent advantages. There's a propensity to have, you know, lower greenhouse gas emissions, are more efficient, yet have very good performance, good fuel economies. We were there banging the diesel drum.
In the days and weeks that followed, Dan Carter and other members of the team did dozens of interviews with major U.S. television networks, newspapers, and magazines. But it was an even bigger story abroad. Journalists called from Britain, Germany, Italy, Australia, and Japan.
And Dan, who is this very unassuming, very modest, very humble guy, became the center of attention around the world.
Gordon Gee, president of West Virginia University.
Volkswagen has ultimately settled for at least $20 billion, and they have a lot of other work to do. And CAFE has become one of the most central places in this country, if not in the world, where emissions tests take place because it's now become a gold standard.
Besides greater attention to West Virginia University's research capabilities, the uncovering of the Volkswagen scandal brought unexpected results. Fred King, Vice President for Research at WVU.
Just last week, we received a message from a member of our Board of Governors, and he was at a meeting of international business leaders in California. And a gentleman noticed that he had the flying WV on his shirt and said, oh, are you from West Virginia University? And he said, yes, I am. And at that point, the person who was with German businesses said, I want you to know the phenomenal impact that the Volkswagen work has had on changing how German businesses view business ethics. Certainly when Dan Carter and his group, they've been doing this work for 20 plus years, they never dreamed that one day what they did would change the way businesses internationally operate.
So, Gene, this is where I grew up. Pretty rural setting. Farms all around us.
We're standing on a hillside behind Dan Carter's childhood home, up Grassy Run Road, a few miles outside Mineral Wells, West Virginia.
The summer times were filled with, you know, riding motorcycles and bicycles and working in hay fields. In the fall, of course, you know, we were always outside. The parents didn't worry. They knew they were a holler away that we would come running. It's amazing to come back and see, you know, the change in the area, but this area stayed relatively untouched. And my nieces now kind of do the same things that I did when I was that age.
I was actually born in Weston in Lewis County. My parents moved to Wood County the next year, and my dad was a union iron worker. So, you know, he kind of followed where the work was. At that time, the Mid-Ohio Valley was growing at DuPont and GE. The plants were booming, Kaiser Aluminum. They moved to a trailer in Parkersburg, Southside. And then 73, they moved into a trailer in Mineral Wells.
Then in 1976, Carter's parents, Dick and Helen Carter, built this house for the family, Dan and his sister Becky. Dick Carter died in 2015, and today Becky lives with her family next door. Dan's mother, Helen Carter.
Dan was a good child. He was a good child. If he was told to do something, we didn't have to second guess ourselves that he was going to do it. He always trying to figure out how to take things apart and put them together. His daddy was that way. Bicycles. Can't remember what birthday it was, the first one. Maybe he was 4 or 5. And I think probably before the kids left the party, the bicycle was already being taken apart.
Not long after that, Dan was tinkering with tractors and cars and taking them apart too. But he also did well at school.
It always came easy to me. I remember first grade, they were wanting to skip me in school. We grew up in a Christian home. My mom, you know, took my sister and I to church from the time we were small. So it was always, you know, be very humble. She would have nothing to do with me skipping because that was pretentious or bragging.
One day the teacher had called me at home and she said, Danny is very irritated because he gets his work done and the other kids aren't finished and he doesn't know what to do. And I said, well, what my suggestion for you to be is the kids that are slow, put Danny with them so he can help them along the way.
That's what I did. I would finish with my stuff and I would, you know, get extra handouts and take them to some of the students and work with them. My elementary school was a three-room schoolhouse. It's now a hardware store.
The hardware store to your right, that was my elementary school for the first 3 years, so kindergarten, first, and second. My first church, Mount Zion Baptist.
Old church, 1815.
Mm-hmm. Old church, and we were there until I was 10, 11 years old. And it was really active in the church, did a lot of singing and playing in the church, and did choir group that would, you know, would go around other area churches and put on little plays or you know, musicals. It was a good time.
When he was in the ninth grade, he walked in from school that evening and he said, Mom, I decided today what I want to do when I get through school. And I said, and that is, and he said, I want to be a mechanical engineer.
I knew young, I wanted to be a mechanical engineer. I'm a huge Ford guy. So my only goal was to go work at Ford Motor Company.
And I said, son, that's all well and good and it sounds great. But I said, where are me and your dad going to be able to get the money to be able to put you through school? Because we didn't have it and neither of our families had money to do that. And he said, I'm sure that you and Dad will find a way.
I'm Becky Melrose. I am Dan Carter's sister. I remember he would like to tear my cars apart to put in stereo systems. I would just want just a little new radio. And by the time he was done, I would go out and he'd have the seats tore out, the doors tore out. And by the time he was done, which was an 8-hour job, as Dan would say, would end up being 2 weeks.
But it was
introduction to what's coming in.
Introduction to what was coming.
Yes, yes, it definitely was.
On Friday nights, Saturday nights, we would cruise around town, and we would travel from Southside. We have a small park below the high school there to Parkersburg City Park. And, you know, at the park, you would pull over, and, you know, obviously everyone would pop their hood, you know, wash their car, polish their car, try to impress everyone about their car. About all we did. If we weren't in a garage, we were cruising this route, I think.
All through high school, work was also a big part of Dan's life. Mowing, fixing equipment, working in restaurants, and at a steel fabrication plant. Yet Dan was still a good student, a co-valedictorian at Parkersburg South High School. He would also sneak out of his AP classes to hang out with the guys in the school's auto shop. Next was West Virginia University. Carter went on to graduate first in his class in mechanical engineering, and then he landed what he thought was his dream job.
At the completion of my bachelor's degree, I got an internship at Ford at Scientific Research Labs, and that particular year they looked at resumes from around the world. I went to a long boardroom and had to answer questions fired at me from engineers around the table. And finally got to be at Ford, and, you know, it seemed like the fairy tale had come true, right?
But after a few months working at Ford, Dan Carter realized his co-workers considered it just a job. Managers at Ford were encouraging him to go on to MIT or the University of Maryland for his master's, but he decided to return to Morgantown, do his master's at WVU, and work at a new place called CAFE, the Center for Alternative Fuels, Engines and Emissions.
What could have been the start of just a career at Ford, or maybe going on to MIT and then coming back to Ford, or coming back to Morgantown and you know, getting involved in the center. I've grown up in CAFE, so that was definitely a big turning point.
Another big turning point in Dan Carter's life came in April 2016. Time magazine listed him among the 100 most influential people in the world for the work that he and his team did in exposing a giant corporation's harmful fraud.
Dan brings to this, I think, the embodiment of the spirit of West Virginians.
Fred King.
First of all, it's an incredible work ethic. Also, Dan is naturally curious. He is a person who, when he sees something, he notices it and he asks the right questions. Kind of a sort of native talent that Dan has is great common sense. And that's not so widely sown among everyone, I must say.
On the other side of Morgantown from CAFE's Research Center, Dan shows me a new facility in its final stages of completion.
Gene, we've just arrived at our vehicle and engine testing laboratory. We're still under construction, finalizing construction. We will eventually have 2 engine dynamometer test cells with full emissions capabilities and 2 vehicle chassis dynamometer test cells with the same emissions capabilities. This is a Mercedes diesel passenger car. This is a vehicle chassis dynamometer. We're doing some comparative work from the mobile unit to the fixed unit on this vehicle. And we're also looking at some of the other manufacturers and you know, what their performance is like.
Dan Carter believes that a testing and development facility such as this will enable the center to work hand in hand with industry, helping them to solve their problems. And he believes CAFE's greatest asset is not their experience, but the students, whose young minds aren't yet set in their ways.
Kids of tomorrow that are dreaming, that's the innovation. I mean, that's the spark. That's what you want to see. We have those young minds, and we hope to link those kids up with the industry.
So have some of your graduates from here gone straight into national and global companies?
Absolutely, yeah. My phone rings at least once a week from a company or a regulator or an independent research organization, you know, asking, okay, how many students do you have? Which ones are ready to graduate? How soon will they graduate? Most kids that leave our group have 3 or 4 job offers before they're finished writing their dissertation or thesis.
For his part, Dan Carter plans to stay right where he is. He lives with his wife, Hillary, and 3 children in rural Preston County in his beloved West Virginia.
My future, I believe our future looks very bright. My future, I intend to stay here. I'm driven by the need to try to figure out a way to bring opportunity and economic development to the state. I still think that West Virginia has some very unique people. We have a hard work ethic. You know, we're always there willing to help our neighbor out. And I think it's time now that we get together and see, you know, forget about the, you know, the Democrats and Republicans and look at what the state can do and how it can move forward. That's where I see myself. I mean, I want my future to be here in the state. I want my kids to be able to grow up here and have opportunity. And I want to be able to make a difference. When I'm retired, if I ever retire, and look back and say, you know, that was a good thing we did. Look at what we did and look at all those jobs and opportunities we developed. And that's what we need to focus on.
You're listening to Inspiring West Virginians. Next, a dirt bike champion from Jefferson County who's a rising star in astrophysics.
So, Gene, we're just here at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We just got into the visitor center. Just want to show you a couple really awesome things going on here at JPL.
I'm Justin Ellis. I'm an astrophysicist. I'm also an Einstein Fellow at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. I also have an appointment at Caltech, California Institute of Technology.
Justin Ellis grew up in a rural area outside Charlestown in Jefferson County, West Virginia.
So over here we have Kepler, which is actually, at least to me, one of the coolest missions that NASA has. So basically what Kepler does is it just stares at a bunch of different stars, and what it's trying to do is it's trying to find planets around those other stars.
Every year, 11 people in the world are named Einstein Fellows. The 3-year postdoctoral fellowship is among the world's most prestigious fellowships in astrophysics. Justin Ellis, only 30 years old, is the only West Virginian ever to win the lucrative award. He could choose to do his research wherever he wanted. Caltech and NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory are exciting places to be.
We found hundreds and hundreds of exoplanets now with Kepler. And just recently, we're starting to find more and more in this so-called Goldilocks zone, which is where, you know, you might be able to have life, right? It's warm enough that you can have liquid water, but it's not so big that you would be crushed by gravity. So Kepler is.
I work on gravitational waves and pulsar timing. So gravitational waves are a major prediction of Einstein's theory of general relativity and many other theories of relativity other than Einstein. So this is a major test of this theory, and people have been trying to detect gravitational waves since the 60s.
Scientists call gravitational waves ripples in the fabric of space-time. They're created by violent events in the distant universe, like giant black holes merging, or even whole galaxies merging. In a fraction of a second, these cataclysmic events release great waves of gravitational energy in every direction. Their existence was first proposed by Albert Einstein in 1916. And so detecting gravitational waves has been one of the most anticipated discoveries in modern science. The sound of 2 massive black holes colliding 1.3 billion years ago. On September 14, 2015, a ripple in the fabric of space, created by the violent collision of these 2 distant black holes, washed across the Earth. As it did, 2 laser-based detectors called LIGO momentarily twitched, confirming the century-old prediction by Albert Einstein.
So this proves that these gravitational waves are real. The best way to think about this is if you picture space as a sheet, what gravity does in general is it's like placing something on the sheet. So you place, you know, a marble on the sheet, it makes a little dimple in the sheet, but it's not very big. So it doesn't have a strong gravitational field. You put a bowling ball on the sheet, it pushes the sheet down even further, has a stronger gravitational field. That's sort of the way to think about how gravity works. The higher the mass, the more it deforms the sheet, which is space.
My name is Michele Vallisneri, and I'm a gravitational wave scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and at Caltech. What I think is remarkable about Justin is that he's brilliant, like many other people here at Caltech, but he's also a true scientist in the sense that he's modest and he'll keep trying to find the truth. He'll just persist, and he's not happy until he knows the answer. And I think this comes from caring about the subject, but it probably comes more from like an innate curiosity and an almost, you know, a Sherlock Holmes-like sense of having to find out the solution to a very difficult problem.
Justin Ellis and his colleagues are working to detect low-frequency gravitational waves with masses many millions of times larger than those detected in 2015. To do this, they're using pulsating radio stars, or pulsars.
Basically, what a pulsar is it's what's left over after a star explodes or after it goes supernova. There's this really dense core left over, and that's called a neutron star. And in some cases, neutron stars, they're rotating and they have these radio jets. So these strong jets of radio waves coming out of the poles. And if that pole is not aligned with the spin, so it looks like a lighthouse, basically. And so that's what pulsars are. They're these spinning, super dense stars that are actually about the size of downtown LA. They're about 8 kilometers across. They're about 1.5 times the mass of the sun. But they're incredibly dense. Like a teaspoon of this would weigh tons. And so you have these lighthouses, basically. And what we do is we use radio telescopes. We go out and we look and we see this repeating source.
Currently, the team is monitoring 55 pulsars using 2 radio telescopes, the Arecibo Telescope in Puerto Rico and the Greenbank Telescope in West Virginia.
There are certain kinds of pulsars that are extremely stable, almost as stable as atomic clocks. We have this perfect clock. So if the distance changes between you and that pulsar, then those pulses would get here a little bit later, a little bit earlier, depending on if it's closer or further away.
So the idea is, if a gravitational wave passes by, some pulses will arrive here earlier and some later, depending on where the gravitational waves are coming from and where the pulsars are in the sky.
We use these specific data analysis techniques to try to look at these pulses as they arrive and try to see how correlated they are. From that, we can determine if a gravitational wave has passed by the system.
Ellis and his colleagues are part of the North American team of scientists looking for gravitational waves, known as nanograv. Estimates vary, but Justin thinks they may detect gravitational waves using pulsars anywhere from the next 3 to 12 years. Astrophysicist Stephen Taylor, who works with Justin Ellis, says gravitational waves will provide an entirely new way of doing astrophysics.
Astronomy and astrophysics has always been done with light. It started with optical. It moved on to using radio as a way to probe the universe. People have used X-rays. People have used gamma rays. This is completely different. This will not use light at all. We're tapping into the way the fabric of the cosmos undulates and the way it vibrates. We're kind of listening to the universe rather than looking at it. And this will allow us to look into objects which are dark, objects that don't radiate light, like black holes do not radiate light. So this is a fundamentally different way of doing astrophysics.
No, that's even the 17,000 residual.
Maybe the other outliers are real too, but that seems to have huge outliers that aren't absorbed into something else.
So how do you actually identify this particular TOA as an outlier?
Justin and his colleagues discussed their latest findings in their search for gravitational waves using pulsars. Justin Ellis has been key in calculating the data analysis algorithms to try to make that detection. Astrophysicist and colleague Stephen Taylor.
He's smart, he's tenacious when he gets a problem, he's happiest when he's doing academic detective work. When a new problem or a new interesting topic arises, he really goes at it with gusto, he likes to get to the bottom of things, and he's an incredibly smart guy.
You would think, wouldn't you, that this incredibly smart guy grew up a science nerd, right? nothing could be further from the truth.
Justin, here we are at your house in Jefferson County. You're just a few miles outside of Charlestown. This is where most of life happened as a youngster.
Yep, this is where almost all of life happened. Right here in the front yard is when I was younger in the baseball days. We used to play wiffle ball out here. So over there by the driveway was home plate. Right where we're standing was first base. That tree was second base. There used to be another tree there. It was third base.
As a teenager, Justin was a real daredevil. On his dirt bike motorcycle, he regularly jumped more than 20 feet off the ground and more than 100 feet in length.
So now we're in the backyard where I spent most of my time from when I was 14 to 18. We used to have a big motocross track back here. We had lots of jumps, probably 3 acres worth. So it was all this field here and then some over there.
He took me to his childhood bedroom to see photos of his feats and his trophies. Lots of trophies.
Oh, my goodness. Above the bed are 12 trophies. Oh, and there's a whole lot more over here.
Yeah, so we did a lot of racing in those 4 years. I guess it was almost every weekend. My favorite trophy is this one.
A lot of the people that I work with, or even that I've met in physics and astronomy, have sort of been the type that, you know, had this thing, oh, I looked up at the stars when I was young, and I really wanted to do astrophysics, and it was sort of this dream goal from when they were really young. My case was not like that at all. So most of the time growing up, I did things you do in the middle of a cornfield, rode dirt bikes and four-wheelers and snowmobiles and things like that.
You were not the typical science nerd.
No, definitely not at all. I've never read a comic book, never seen Star Trek until I was 18. I didn't watch Star Wars. I didn't have any of these stereotypical things. I watch lots of action movies.
I'm Karen Ellis, Justin's mom. What was Justin like as a little boy? Wild, mischievous, just your run-of-the-mill little hellion.
When you say wild and mischievous, what do you mean by that?
He was a big prankster, always out running with the dog, shooting BB guns, tricking his mom, getting sprayed with the water guns. Just all-out boy.
I'm Roger Ellis, and I'm Justin's father. He was a very good kid. I mean, yes, he was mischievous. If he got himself into trouble, he was the one that beat himself up first. He was always his own worst critic.
My parents never pushed me. I think they sort of just instilled this competition. My mom was a jockey. She was really competitive. My dad was just always incredibly supportive. So I got the moral support from both of them, but definitely my dad, and my mom just was super competitive. They sort of instilled that in me, but they never pushed me after that. It was almost more like I had this competitive thing, and after that, nobody had to push me because I was my own worst critic.
Even when Justin got to high school and making A's, he still had no intention of doing science. But his 10th grade history teacher thought differently.
One day she went around and she was trying to predict what her students would do. And she said, Justin, you're going to be a scientist. And I said, oh, I don't know. I don't think so. Because at the time I was thinking about sociology and criminal justice. I wanted to work for the FBI or CIA or something like that.
So when Ellis started his freshman year at Shepherd University nearby, he planned to major in sociology.
My first semester, I had just a general science class that we had to take. The professor for that class, he was an astrophysicist, so it was mostly astrophysics related. And he was just so amazingly charismatic and upbeat and just really awesome and really got me interested in this. And pretty much from then on, I decided, okay, I think this is what I want to do. But I was a little bit behind because up until this point, I'd never taken anything in school related to this because I just never thought about it. In terms of science, where I'm at now, the biggest motivation was definitely my professor at Shepherd, Dr. Best. I'm almost certain I would not have done any of this if I wouldn't have had his class.
Justin, we're here together at the Shepherd University campus on an absolutely gorgeous day.
This is where everything started. I started here in 2004, and I was here for 2.5 years. The very first class I ever had, and I was late. It's a bit embarrassing, but you know, it turned out good since then.
Well, let's go meet Dr. Best.
Yep, sounds good.
We make our way to Dr. Jason Best's office with Justin's PhD dissertation tucked under his arm.
So, Dr. Best, here is the long-awaited copy of my thesis.
I know you've been anxiously awaiting it.
I truly have. I've had a spot on my shelf that's been waiting for it, because when you look at something like this, you recognize the culmination of all of your work, all of your effort, and to be able to see it distilled in such a way is, I think, always gratifying.
I was just telling Jean earlier that my first day, I realized that you can't park anywhere on this side of campus. I said I was 10 or 15 minutes late for your class, and the door was closed. I had to knock on it. I was very nervous.
As they talk, it becomes apparent that not only did Professor Best change Justin Ellis's life, Justin had an impact on Professor Best's life as well.
And I've told people this. I pointed out that I've had actually one student in my career who went on to become an astrophysicist, and it's you. And that you're, you know, leaps and bounds smarter than I am. You're better at this than I ever will be. And that's how it's supposed to work. Because the students.
But there was no physics major at Shepherd. So after 2.5 years, Justin Ellis transferred to West Virginia University, where he had to take loads of science and math classes to catch up with other physics majors. A professor at West Virginia University, Maura McLaughlin, is the person who got Justin interested in gravitational waves. He went on to earn a Ph.D. in 3 years at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
I think I came in at a really good time, because I came in right when this field was pretty new. I was one of the first people really trying to develop these algorithms for how to detect things. So getting on the ground floor, and I could develop a lot of new things, and I had a lot of publications with new things. And so it was a really good time, and you could build yourself up as a leader in this area fairly fast.
In just 10 years, Justin Ellis went from a dirt bike and motocross champion to a rising star in gravitational wave research, the hot new field in modern astronomy.
I think I enjoy that sense of discovery the most, even if it's nothing big. If you come up with some way of doing something that's faster, or just something that's new, that there was some problem that people couldn't figure out, and then you figure it out, I think that's probably the best.
The work that Justin Ellis is doing is exploring the largest scales that exist. He is making discoveries on literally the biggest scales imaginable.
Since finishing his PhD, Justin Ellis has also given himself permission to start doing new things, like reading more books outside science, walking the dog with his wife, listening to history podcasts, and returning to his happy place, his childhood home in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Jefferson County, West Virginia.
Being back home, one of the things I always miss the most is just being able to sit here and be quiet and just hear birds and not really hear people around you. Our closest neighbor is probably a quarter of a mile away. So usually when I come back, I like to just sit outside and listen to it. But it's really nice just to be back and relax.
For our final story, an entrepreneur from Summers County who brought his business back to West Virginia and in the process is transforming his hometown and inspiring the whole state.
My name's Ken Allman. I'm founder and CEO of PracticeLink.com, one of the nation's largest and oldest online physician job banks. I grew up in Hinton, West Virginia, and soon after college, I landed in St. Louis, Missouri. And now I live in St. Louis and make frequent trips back to my hometown of Hinton. The reason I come back to Hinton, other than the scenic beauty and my friends and family, is that in 1999, I relocated my bootstrap startup business out of my one-bedroom apartment in St. Louis and set up headquarters here in Hinton, in the historic district.
At PracticeLink's company headquarters in Hinton, 54-year-old Ken Allman, tall and blonde, oversees a staff of 25. Another 20 employees are located in Louisville, Kentucky and St. Louis, Missouri. Although it's not a large company, about half of the doctors in the United States have used PracticeLink at one time or another when job hunting. Each year, more than 20,000 physicians across the country register with PracticeLink in search of the right position. And healthcare providers pay to find out who they are and what they have to offer.
PracticeLink's really a very simple business model. Hospitals and medical groups, healthcare systems, academic institutions, government agencies, the military, they often struggle to get all the physicians they need by specialty or in quality or in quantity. And PracticeLink serves the needs of just about every entity in the country that recruits physicians.
Each year, for example, the VA recruits 200 to 300 physicians for their hospitals and medical centers across the country. Terry Anderson recruits for VA facilities in Washington, D.C., Maryland, and West Virginia.
PracticeLink is very valuable to me in regards to recruiting highly qualified physicians for the VA to care for our veterans. I use PracticeLink probably 80% of the time. Just about every physician that I know throughout the nation utilizes PracticeLink. And I can tell you, my colleagues love it. It's our number one tool in our toolbox. And I had the opportunity to actually meet Ken. And when I told him, hey, I'm from West Virginia, his eyes lit up. We must have talked for about an hour and a half. And we're at a conference, national conference. He's the president, he's the CEO of it. And he gave me all that time.
Why did you move your business back here to Hinton, West Virginia?
I was in my very early 30s. It was a leap. It was right at the beginning of the internet. I was single. I had a little bit of a vision, and I took a chance and tried to explore that vision. And it was very difficult for the first few years. But as an online internet company, around 1995, there was a lot of uncertainty about my ability to make a go of this. And I really didn't have the financial resources. It was just an idea. And coming back to Hinton allowed me to learn. It was an inexpensive way to operate an online business in a small town. And I think it was one of the best things I could have ever done.
But bringing his business back to Hinton, a town of less than 3,000 people, was quite a risk at the time. The once prosperous rail town was in the midst of a long downturn. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Hinton, West Virginia grew rapidly as a railroad town, employing hundreds of rail workers. It boasted several hotels, churches, banks, hospitals, and theaters. On top of that, it's the gateway to some of the most beautiful parts of West Virginia, lying in a valley where three rivers come together, the Bluestone, the Greenbrier, and the New. Even during Allman's childhood in the late 60s and 70s, it was thriving.
Hinton was an all-American town. It had a very lively downtown. We had incredible festivals and parades, and church life was very vibrant, and the old high school rivalries were exciting. Movies on Saturdays at the Ritz Theater. Downtown, we had a dozen little restaurants, dress shops, shoe stores, men's shops, little sporting goods store, little hardware stores, a couple of different pharmacies.
Ken Allman's roots in Hinton and West Virginia run deep.
My sister and I grew up here in Hinton. Both sides of our family go so far back, I can't really tell you what generation we are of West Virginian. Our father, our grandfathers, our uncles on both sides of the family, they were employees of the Chesapeake and Ohio Railway, later the Chessie system, and then eventually what became CSX. My father was born in Beard, West Virginia, in Pocahontas County, and he grew up in Ronsford in Greenbrier County before coming to Hinton after the Korean War, where he served in the Air Force and settled in Hinton as a railroad brakeman and conductor. My mom and her family, they grew up here in Summers County. My grandparents grew up a few miles apart. My grandfather was a pipe fitter in the Roundhouse. He had a gospel quartet, and I grew up in a lot of one-room churches throughout the county, along with my mom going to various gospel singing conventions.
Radio.
my mother and father met here in the Hinton Historic District, only a half a block from where we're sitting right now. Our life evolved around youth sports, church, homework, playing with the neighborhood kids. We played sandlot football and wiffle ball and had acorn battles, and we stayed up late playing Risk and Monopoly. None of us will ever forget those memories. It was kind of an all-American blue-collar neighborhood and a really great life.
Greg Rogers, who was a childhood friend of Ken's, remembers that he was always kind and stood up to bullies.
He could have been a bully in grade school, middle school, high school. He was always bigger than everybody else. He was always stronger than everybody else. But he was the peacemaker. Ken was the one that always protected the ones that were getting bullied because he was bigger and stronger, but he didn't let anybody bully anybody else.
In terms of a career, Ken Ullman didn't know what he wanted to do. He spent his first 2 years of college at Concord University nearby and finished up with a degree in biology from Alderson Broaddus in Philippi, all the time working weekends at a local supermarket in Hinton. He spent his 20s doing various jobs in sales, management consulting, and physician recruitment before starting Practice Link from his apartment in St. Louis, Missouri. In the early 1980s, shortly after Ken left Hinton, the town changed.
The 1980s were a very difficult time here. Railroad operations were consolidated, and the completion of I-64 bypassed Hinton. And those two things together contributed to a bit of a 20-year recession here in our community. But as Practice Link's grown and as our community has evolved with local leadership and civic leadership, Hinton has achieved a level of hope, not only for our community, but other communities as well.
The transformation of downtown historic Hinton has been striking. Since 2007, Ken Ullman, his family, his colleagues, and other community members have restored numerous buildings and opened new businesses of all kinds that cater for locals and tourists alike. Ken Ullman started another business, Mountainplex Properties. Today, it manages 20 local buildings.
I'm standing here in the Ritz Theater in Hinton, West Virginia, with you, Ken Ullman, and his sister, Sheila. Tell me how this all came about.
We didn't exactly plan on entering the theater business, but it provided a venue for the growth of the company. And the Ritz Theater was built in 1929. It's one of several theaters that existed in the Hinton Historic District. It's the only one remaining. Sheila and I and many of our friends and many, many generations, our parents, grew up in this theater.
We have had generations come in here. This past weekend, we had people come in that hadn't been here in 20 or 30 years, and they were amazed when they looked in here, and they said they missed it.
We transformed it from a rundown large movie house to what you see now, which it was beautifully restored in 2009 with digital cinema, digital sound. We can host business functions here. We can host live events here, and we show movies every weekend.
Are you as inspired as your brother to preserve and renew Hinton?
I think there might be a little competition on who's more. Who's more?
You might be more inspired than he is.
More inspired on it, right.
What inspires you to try to bring Hinton back to life?
When we did the first two sides of the windows of the McCreary building, and I noticed what a big difference that was, it was like turning on the lights. It's just beautiful.
So, Jean, we're leaving the Ritz Theater. We're stepping out here, and one thing that I think we're really proud of is our brick street. So we're going to work our way over to the market just across the street, and I think we're meeting with my mom. My mom, Rosemary. It's a short walk, a little bit of a rainy day. Sorry about that. But we're walking by what's about to become the plaza, Rivertown Plaza, at the corner of Ballingy and 2nd. And this has really been the focus of our efforts over the last several years. From here, you can see the five-story McCreary Hotel built in 1907. You can see the incredible courthouse and the restoration work that the county is doing there, the post office. This is a very historical corner. John F. Kennedy spoke on this corner during his election bid. This is really one of the most beautiful corners I think you can find in any small town. The Hinton Historic District, it's a national historic district, and it's 16 square blocks, which makes it one of the largest national historic districts in the country. Most of it's looks just the way it did when it was built 100 years ago.
We've come across the street to the market on Courthouse Square, where folks come to meet and chat.
And my mom. So three classmates and my mom.
Kenny was, he was a good little boy. Maybe not everybody in the neighborhood thought so, but I did. But he liked to play army, and he's very loving, tender-hearted, and just a sweet little boy in my book.
He wasn't a lot of trouble.
He wasn't. Him and his sister both were, they were good kids. I remember his fourth grade teacher, Miss Hazel Davidson, told me one day, she said, I often wonder what Kenny will grow up to be. And I'm looking at her like, why? You know, and she said, because he always starts a sentence out, I wonder what if. And she did live to see some of his success.
Of all the things that Ken has done, of what are you the most proud?
I'm just proud of the way he's turned out, loving and giving. I wish his daddy was living to see what he has accomplished.
She added that she's proud, too, of the deep Christian faith of both of her children.
Me too. I got to do that.
Another few steps up the street, we meet people sitting on the front porch of the Guesthouse Inn on Courthouse Square, open since 2007. Four buildings were restored to create this beautiful bed and breakfast facility. It's popular among business guests of the town, as well as folks coming to Hinton for vacations and reunions.
There's a lot of people coming home. There really is. That is what has us looking at the possibility of expanding that a little further.
I'm thankful somebody's showing the interest.
Yeah. Ken Allman is a very interesting individual in that he has more ideas in 5 minutes than I'll have in 5 years.
Businessman and childhood friend Greg Rogers.
His mind is always working. He's always thinking. He's a visionary. He's always out in front and thinking about bringing his business back to Hinton. A soft spot in his heart brought that back to West Virginia, which he could have left it in another state, but he was concerned about the people in his hometown and did everything that he could within his power to benefit the folks in his hometown of Hinton, West Virginia.
Ken Allman, Practice Link, and Mountainplex Properties have been honored for their work. In 2014, Ken was named Small Business Person of the Year in West Virginia. That same year, Practice Link magazine was named the top publication of the year in healthcare in the United States. In 2016, Allman was honored by the West Virginia Preservation Alliance for the historic preservation work in Hinton. Jack David Woodrum, president of the Summers County Commission, acknowledges that many people have wanted to redevelop and restore Hinton, and many have contributed to that effort. But Ken Allman has made the biggest difference.
With what Kenny's been able to bring to the county, when you look out one of the windows here, I mean, you look around, it looks like you're looking at a postcard. Growing up here, you know, I've seen business at its peak, and I've watched it go away. And it's remarkable what he's been able to do, and the facelift he's given to town and the inspiration he's provided to others to do the same has been tremendous.
Terry Giles, who has known Allman and his sister Sheila since they were children, calls Ken Allman a prince.
What I mean is that he embodies the spirit of Hinton, and I believe the spirit of West Virginians. He never forgets where he comes from. He is always eternally optimistic about the abilities of people from Hinton, people from West Virginia. He is committed to the future of our state. He is a prince in the sense that he does not lord it over anyone, but he inspires people to rise up with him. He has re-inspired our hometown of Hinton to remember what we were and what we are and what we can be.
In his late 40s, the longtime bachelor Ken Allman married Julie, an interior designer. They live in St. Louis, but regularly travel back and forth to Hinton. And recently they've been blessed with a young son, Charles. Wherever they are, West Virginia is not far from their thoughts.
You know, I love West Virginia. It just energizes me. Wherever I am in the world, if Country Roads comes on, I'm probably like a lot of other West Virginians. I can't help but get emotional. there's something that ties us all together as West Virginians that we can't take for granted.
The extraordinary rebirth of Hinton, West Virginia would not have been possible without the success of PracticeLink, the online physician recruitment company that Ken Allman started more than 20 years ago.
From our humble beginnings in our beautiful, humble little community here, we affect the entire world of healthcare nationwide on a daily basis. That's an amazing feeling. We're not the biggest company in healthcare. We're a small company that makes a big difference.
You've been listening to the seventh and final season of Inspiring West Virginians. There are hundreds of thousands of people from this state who are inspiring West Virginians. We all know that. But this group of people have distinguished themselves in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and business. It's been quite a ride. Over the last 7 years, I've had the privilege of meeting 29 people from small towns and rural areas in 22 different counties across the great state of West Virginia. Among them are three physicians, three astrophysicists, two paleoclimatologists, a field biologist, a biochemist, a pharmacologist, a computer architect, a biophysicist and electrical engineer, two energy engineers, one structural engineer, a mechanical engineer, an aeronautical engineer, one mathematician, three business entrepreneurs, three social entrepreneurs, and four top CEOs in software, fashion, government, and IT. All of these folks are known across the United States, and in most cases, they are global leaders in their fields. Yet they were happy to be profiled for Inspiring West Virginians, partly because they want to inspire the next generation of leaders in science, engineering, and business. I must also add that four got away. One turned me down, two said they were too busy, and the fourth, I simply waited too long to ask her. That's 98-year-old NASA mathematician and winner of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, Katherine Johnson, from White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia. But it's possible to see Katherine's inspiring story in the new Hollywood film, Hidden Figures. Finally, I want to thank Suzanne Higgins at West Virginia Public Broadcasting for her incredible enthusiasm for this series. I'm Jean Snediger, your producer and host for Inspiring West Virginians. It's been my pleasure.
Inspiring West Virginians was produced and presented by Jean Snediger. The senior producer for West Virginia Public Broadcasting is Suzanne Higgins. Music was provided by Roma Yagnik, Doug Van Gundy, and the West Virginia Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Grant Cooper. Special thanks go to the CAFI team at West Virginia University, to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and Caltech in Pasadena, California, to PracticeLink, Mountain Plex Properties, and the good people of Hinton, West Virginia, and to Davis and Elkins College in Elkins, West Virginia. You can hear these stories and all the Inspiring West Virginians profiles by visiting wvpublic.org. Inspiring West Virginians is made possible by the generous support of the Miles Family Foundation, inspiring West Virginians to soar.